The following Dharma talk was recorded in St. Louis, Missouri in August 2012 at a retreat sponsored by Mid-America Dharma. More talks from their retreats can be found at www.midamericadharma.org. The speaker is Shyla Catherine, founding teacher of Insight Meditation South Bay in California. More teachings and information about her work can be found at www.imsb.org.
So the subject for this evening's talk is views and opinions. This is an important topic in the Dharma practice because, as Ajahn Chah, a Thai forest master, said, the greatest hindrance is views and opinions. And in the middle-length discourses, the Buddha said, if a person has a belief, he preserves truth when he says, my belief is thus. He does not yet come to the definite conclusion, only this is true, anything else is wrong. The Buddha is acknowledging that we have beliefs. Beliefs arise. We construct them. They're part of normal discourse, normal life. And this process is not a bad process. It's not an evil process. But rather than putting forth Buddhist truths that we must believe, the Buddha asks us to consider whether or not we have solidified a perspective, taken a view, created a viewpoint, a stance, and from that perspective, consider ourselves correct and everything else wrong. It invites us to consider how frequently we think we're right, and how much space we allow to consider the possibility that we might be wrong. How easily do we admit that we're wrong? Do we feel okay about being wrong? In the Buddha's day, he lived at a time and in a culture where there was a flourishing spiritual debate and a remarkable tolerance for religious freedom and open philosophical discourse. The ancient Indian culture encouraged debate, and the wanderers of various sects, of various schools of thought, who followed various different teachers and engaged in different practices, would frequently meet in the public parks that were their sanctuaries and resorts. And there they would discuss the Dhamma, they would discuss their practices, they would debate various philosophical points and various spiritual beliefs. Sometimes in these debates and discussions, arguments broke out. And we'll find little snippets of these interactions recorded in the Buddhist canon. But when we read something in the Buddhist canon about the beliefs of other sects, we have to take it with a little bit of a grain of salt. Because just as the victor in a battle always has a certain way of viewing history, religious texts always have a certain way of viewing the other that's positioned so as to reveal its own good points. So, although we can take this with a grain of salt, we can still see that there's a teaching here. And in the Udana, the Buddha said, wanderers of other sects are quarrelsome and argumentative, arguing, the Dhamma is like this, no. The Dhamma is like that, no. The Dhamma is like this, no. The Dhamma is like that, no. You can get the idea. They were arguing about their different positions, about how things are. And the Buddha described them as being like blind men. And he told a story of a king who invited a group of blind men to describe an elephant. And he sent each of the blind men up to the elephant. And the one that touched the trunk of the elephant described the elephant as being just like a hose. And the one who touched the tail of the elephant described the elephant as being just like a whisk broom. And the one who touched the foot and the leg of the elephant said, "No, you're both wrong. An elephant is just like the trunk of a tree." And depending on what part of the elephant each one encountered, what that person's experience was, they described the elephant differently. But this story is told to say that none of them could know the elephant. None of them could experience or see the whole. And the Buddha ended this discourse with the statement, "Some recluses and Brahmins, so-called, are deeply attached to their own views. People who see only one side of things engage in quarrels and disputes." We all do have our perspective. We have our opinions. We have our experiences. And even the most spiritually awake and developed people that I have met still have views that are conditioned by their generation, their culture, their education, their politics, their gender roles. We've formed ways of doing things, and to us they seem fair, they seem good, they seem right, they seem efficient. And often we don't even recognize that it's just a viewpoint until we've traveled someplace else. And I recommend traveling to foreign cultures, if for no other reason than to see in your own experience that the way you do things is not the only way to do things. Now, you may not know this if you just stay in 4-star hotels around the planet, but if you go and you live in a village hut somewhere, you're going to find that there is a different way to wash dishes. If you go someplace, you're going to find that businesses operate with different assumptions. Transactions are arranged in different ways. If you don't want to travel to a different culture to discover this, just invite a group of people over to your own home and cook dinner together. You will find that if you have 6 people chopping onions, you're going to have 6 different ways those onions are going to be peeled and chopped. They all might get chopped in the end, but we all have different ways of doing things. Now, on this retreat, we didn't have any kitchen jobs. Food was provided for us by the staff here. But some retreat centers, you can volunteer to help in the kitchen. And then you might chop carrots or peel potatoes or do various things, and you can look around and see how many different ways there are of doing things. Some retreat centers have certain ways they like them done. I was chopping vegetables at one retreat, and what the cooks would do is they would take one carrot, for example, and they would cut it the way that they want you to do it, and they would put a model, an example of the slice next to each of the cutting boards and the knives for each station of the various volunteers, so that we wouldn't have to talk. We would see the carrot is 1 inch thick and it was cut on a diagonal and it was done just about this angle, and we would try to replicate it. You'd think if you did that, you would pretty much get carrots that would match, but no. You look around and somebody has the idea, I know a better way to cut that carrot. It would look so much better if it was at this angle, and it would cook faster if it was thinner. Or it would be more efficient to do it this way and then do it there. So people end up doing it their own ways. It's very interesting to watch people in a kitchen. Now, Sometimes I notice this when I travel to teach. I recently came back from a three-month teaching tour where I was teaching in Israel for a month, and then in France, and then I wasn't teaching in England. I practiced for a month in England. But I love going to Israel because, well, I love the teaching there. I teach there regularly now, and there are many things I love about the dynamic culture and the way the Dhamma is growing there. But I always get a kick out of breakfast at the retreat center. I go to breakfast, and on the table, there's oatmeal and porridge. That's familiar to me. And then there's this bowl of tahina and some cheese that's kind of like sour cream. They call it labané, but it's kind of like thick sour cream with a little olive oil on top. But all of that seems sort of breakfast-like still. But then there's this tray of cucumbers, tomatoes, and bell peppers. And I always get a kick out of this because I just can't conceive of bell peppers and oatmeal together. It doesn't fit in my brain. Now, I've already been to Israel 5 times, and every time at breakfast I look at it and I think, does not compute. So when you travel and you go to another culture, you'll see little things that are done differently, that are actually just fine. Why not eat bell peppers for breakfast? The basic idea here is we adopt a certain way of doing things because of our culture, our upbringing, our habits. It becomes familiar. We think it's the way things should be done. And over time, it develops into a view. This is the right way to do it. This is the best way to do it. And so we create a familiar place for ourselves through these assumptions and these routines. But if we hold fixed to a viewpoint, not only will we be limiting our perspective on life, but we'll be inhibiting the capacity to see experience as it is. In order to grow, in order to learn, in order to experience life freshly, in order to be mindful of the present moment, we have to be willing to drop our preconceived notions. Just as if we want to have a cup of clean, fresh water, if our glass is already filled with old, dirty, muddy water, we have to be willing to dump out that water, that old, dirty water, before we can fill it with something clean. When we have a view, it might be our experience, it might be our reality, but it might not be another person's reality. And if we want to meet that person and see where they're coming from and what they're expressing and listen very fully, be really present with them, we have to be willing to let go of our perspective, to not hold it so rigidly. To empty our glass enough to let some of their experience in. There was a nice story of a little experiment that put 3 buckets of water. One was hot, and one was cold. So on 2 ends, there was a hot bucket and a cold bucket, and then one was in the middle, which was kind of lukewarm. And a person was asked to stand with 1 hand in the cold bucket and 1 hand in the warm bucket. And then another person was asked to stand with 1 hand in the hot bucket and 1 hand in the warm bucket. And they were asked to describe the bucket that they both had a hand in. They're touching exactly the same water. And one would say, it's hot. The other one would say, it's cold, it's hot, it's cold, it's hot, it's cold. Because we often know things through the comparison and the relative comparison with something else in our lives. And every person will be comparing their experience and developing their views through comparisons to a different history, a different past, a different perspective. we may have our opinions and our viewpoints, our interpretations, but it's helpful to sometimes consider what those opinions are based upon so that we're mindful of the experience that is forming that perspective and to recognize that it might not be applicable to everybody else. In one Dhamma teacher training program that I attended some years ago, one of the teachers gave a nice comment, and he said, "It is easy to be wrong about what others need." And I think that's a very good reminder. We can sometimes have such a clear perspective as though we're sure what somebody should do. But it's easy to be wrong. And knowing that, when we ask a teacher for advice, what we're really asking for is their perspective from their viewpoint, trusting that they have seen things from another perspective and maybe seen things from a more neutral perspective or from a more informed perspective, or maybe they've been through similar things. But we always have to know that they don't know our experience. And so we accept and consider the advice that we hear from others, from friends, from teachers, and we reflect upon it, and some of it we'll reject, and some of it we'll apply, but we'll digest it ourselves and see what is actually useful for our situation. Please reflect for a moment on some views that you hold, places that you know you have a strong viewpoint. Maybe it's about how Vipassana should be presented in the West. Maybe it's about where you're at with your meditation practice. Maybe it's about how your Sangha should be organized, or how a retreat should be run. Maybe it's about politics and what our government should or should not do. Maybe you have a view or an opinion about what a family member or a friend should do, how they should live their lives, what choice they should make, who they should or shouldn't marry, what kind of job they should or shouldn't get, what kind of school they should or shouldn't go to, whether they should retire or not, whether they should invest their money this way or that way. Consider if you have opinions about your friends, your neighbors, your colleagues, your family. When you know that you have an opinion, write it down, just so that you can see what that belief is. And then examine it. Whether it's a belief about your Dhamma teacher, whether it's a belief about the government, whether it's a belief about health practices, whatever it's a belief about, write it down and then ask two questions. Is this true? Can I actually know if it's true? Some of you might be familiar with the teachings of a woman named Byron Katie, who asks these two questions plus a series of questions with the purpose of primarily deconstructing this belief that we know how things should be. And so we look at how we construct our reality through these views, how we determine and condition our experience through what we think about it. See if you can notice what your opinions are based on, what experiences maybe in your own history have formed that viewpoint, and see if those are actually relevant to the current situation or not. And notice if it's really always that way, or if there's contradictory evidence that you're just not opening to. For example, if you have a belief, "I am like this, I'm this kind of person," are you always like that? In all relationships, all the time? Check it out and see if it's true. Ben Franklin said, "The older I grow, the more apt I am to doubt my own judgment, even on matters I was once certain of, because when I received fuller information or new arguments, I found that I was often wrong in the beliefs that I had originally formed." And I think a little Ben Franklin wisdom is good to toss into a Dhamma talk so that we can have a sense that, you know, we all have views. Can we recognize that we're sometimes and perhaps often wrong? Take, for example, your opinion about your own meditation practice. What do you consider to be good practice? Do you have a view, an image, an idea of what you should be experiencing to be successful in your meditation practice? For example, emotions arise sometimes in meditation. How do you relate to the emotion? Do you consider strong emotions, sadness, grief, fear, ecstasy, joy, whatever it might be? Do you experience these to be good practice? Do you experience them as a sign of depth, deep purification, the unfolding of deep feelings, being in touch with reality, being in touch with who you are, feeling alive? Or do you consider it to be a sign of terrible practice, not being equanimous, the mind being absorbed in emotional response, indulging in feeling unsettled? How do you interpret the arising of an emotion? I've had sequences of interviews where one student will come to speak to me about an emotion, say of anger arising, and they're really happy that they're getting into this emotion and feeling alive and working with it. And then the next student will come really upset that this strong emotion of anger has arisen, that their practice is terrible, they have no equanimity. And yet the emotion is the same, but the view about it is different. The same happens with grief. The same happens with many strong emotions. This may not happen just with emotions. Another situation that I often see different viewpoints around is concentration, the development of concentration. Is it important or is it not important in practice? Some teachers will emphasize the need for strong, focused, steady concentration and consider samadhi, that deep concentration, that pervasive stability of mind, to be the primary condition that makes insight effective and liberating. Other teachers will give virtually no attention to concentration, and they'll emphasize other qualities, such as integrating the mindfulness in daily life, or a relaxed, spacious onlooking, a kind of letting go practice, or a practice of observing our view of things, our attitude, our intentions. And then if you get these different schools of thought or teachers together, there might be some disagreement, both using the suttas as the authority and the source, both believing they are interpreting the Buddha's authentic teaching. And there can be controversies that arise even around the cultivation of a wholesome state. There can also be controversies in the Buddhist tradition around the teachings of karma and rebirth. Is it necessary to believe, to explore, to consider, to teach karma and rebirth? There are some teachers that say a Buddhist teacher must teach rebirth. Others will say it's inappropriate to teach that in the West. We don't know it to be a fact from our own lived experience. Other teachers will say, well, there are practices that one can actually do to see this for themselves. So do those practices, and then let's discuss it. You can get all kinds of arguments around something like this. And what are they but viewpoints? You can get to discussions and differences of view around stages of enlightenment. Where, what exactly the different stages are. What is the defining feature of an experience of enlightenment or awakening? What is the goal that the Buddha taught? Where does this path lead? And there'll be a lot of similarity, but there'll also be some differences and some distinctions in how enlightenment is presented. And as students of Dhamma, it's worth considering what it is you aspire for, so that you don't just adopt something because it is said to you. Different people will interpret even the ethical precepts differently. Some people will take a very strict view of the precepts. For example, the fifth precept of not using intoxicants. Other people will soften it and say, yeah, but a glass of wine at dinner or a beer once in a while with friends is not intoxication. It's just fine. Somebody else who takes a stricter view will ask, is your meditation practice affected by that one glass of wine? And if it is, if there's any dullness in mind, or if there's any tendency towards sloth, then it is affecting the quality of mind and should not be used. So even the ethical precepts, people can have different views. Fortunately, in the Buddhist tradition, we have a very strong tradition to not impose those views. We present the teachings of the five precepts, and it's very much up to individuals to understand what they are themselves and to keep reflecting and being mindful so that it's a practice. It's not a static thing. It's a practice to refine those precepts and to live according to guidelines that keep our action mindful and clear. In my discussion group in a couple of weeks at home, I have a discussion group that I meet with my active volunteers every couple of months for, instead of a task-oriented volunteer kind of thing, we just talk about Dhamma. Because it's too easy in an organization to get together with volunteers and to only talk about our business, you know, our work. So now we've started to meet every other month, and I choose a different Dhamma topic just for sharing, for discussion, for exploration. And this month's topic is metta. And I've asked them to listen to three different Dhamma talks by three different teachers who are arguing three different perspectives on the use of metta. Now, who would argue about metta, right? I mean, loving kindness, friendliness, it's lovely. But some people see it as a concentration practice. Others say, no, it's not a concentration practice. It's an insight practice. And some see it as a practice of purification of the tendencies, of overcoming the ill will, of softening the heart and mind. How do we perceive, what's our view of the practices that we do? Okay, when I say we're arguing about it, we're not coming to blows about these things. But there are different perspectives. I encourage my students to read Dhamma a lot, to read from different perspectives, and to not read the bestsellers. Okay, one bestseller is fine of each author, but to not just go through the things that everybody else is reading, but to look for something else, to look for something that's hidden, even if it's not as entertaining reading. Look for something to give yourself another perspective on things than whatever the dominant view is that's coming into our culture. Once we've established a view, it's a dangerous thing, because we identify with it. And then it becomes the perspective that we compare, better than, worse than. And we establish hierarchies based upon it. It's natural that we're going to have some views about our practice, about the Dhamma. And so we care so deeply about it. We love the practice. We yearn for freedom, for awakening. We're going to feel strongly about it. And if somebody speaks and has a view in such a way that it threatens something that we cherish so much or presents misinformation about it, we might feel that kind of hair at the back of the neck kind of stand up and get riled up about it. It's interesting to notice that, to recognize, woo, I have a view about this. And see what that perspective is. See what it's serving before engaging in a discussion or debate so that we know where we're coming from. There are a lot of Dhamma arguments or sectarian conflicts that have gone on over relatively minuscule differences of opinion. Really rather small things in the scope of things. Musong at the Barry Center for Buddhist Studies said, "What would it be like if we could train ourselves to softly note, this is the deluded mind at work, each time an opinion is formed in the mind? Can we recognize the arising of delusion?" Students often come and start the interview by telling me, "My practice is so terrible," or, "My practice is finally going well." And just in that assessment, they've already formed an opinion about their practice. When I've practiced with traditional Burmese teachers, there's a general tendency to incline or to require non-interpretive reporting of the what's happening in the interviews. So what's happening in the meditation. So for instance, working with one style of practice, I would go to the interview and I would be asked to just report what I noticed. So I might say, I observed the rising of the abdomen, and on the rising, I noticed tingling and coolness. I noticed the coolness for several notes of cool and cool, cool. And it started to, it came as a staccato kind of stop and start and then turned into a pulsing, throbbing sensation. When at the beginning of the falling movement, I noticed tingling and pressure. And then there was a thought and an experience of fear that I noticed for just a moment before coming back to the pressure, which at that point was stronger and more intense. I noticed it as unpleasant. And the unpleasant continued for several moments before it dissipated. Then I heard a sound, you know, like that. So you just kind of, like a chronology or a chronicle of events, and you try to take as neutral an observing stance when you describe your meditation practice to these teachers. Now, my current teacher doesn't require any kind of formal interview style. You just go in and talk about your practice. But over the years that I've worked with him in a monastic kind of setting, the doors are often open with the interviews, so you hear what somebody else is reporting. And so I've heard many, many different people reporting to him and been able to sort of see where they get to, where they go. And the reporting style has a strong effect on communicating what's happening with the teacher. And the people who added a lot of interpretation to their interviews and created more of a personal story had a much harder time developing the progression of instructions than somebody who just went in and said, "I'm seeing this, I'm experiencing this, it feels this way, I noticed this and that," and keeping it very neutral. So when you work with different teachers, it's important to not only sense what's happening in your practice, but sense what that teacher, particularly traditional teachers, are listening for, so that you can give them the information that they need to guide your practice. these kinds of neutral interviews, although very common in the Asian Buddhist world, are relatively uncommon in the West because so many Dhamma teachers blend the Dhamma teachings with more of personal development or a therapeutic process. And in many ways, most Western Dhamma teachers are just psychologically more savvy, even if they're not psychotherapists. They're just a little bit more in tune with the psychological components and the personality structures than many Asian monastics are. So it's helpful, though, to tune in to what the dynamic is so that you can use the opportunities you have with teachers most fully. But I've seen this neutral style to be very frustrating to students who are used to seeking an affirmation in the communication, and especially frustrating in a long silent environment where the only affirmation we might get is in that interaction with a teacher. And when you can't even say anything about your story or your experience or your interpretation or even whether you thought it was a good sitting or not, and you just say these neutral comments, it can be very frustrating. But it's an interesting process to go through because it's another technique to take the fuel away from self-construction. Most of us probably are too intelligent to think that our views are always true. You probably know views change, they're impermanent. And sometimes we're wrong, even though mostly we're right. Sometimes we might possibly be wrong. And I think most of us are somewhat willing to change our views as we learn, as we grow. We may not always want to admit it publicly, but I think we usually are relatively malleable. Otherwise, you probably wouldn't be exploring the nature of the mind. You know, you have to have an open mind to want to do this practice. So it's unlikely that we're attached to our opinions as everlasting and unchanging God-given truths. We're just more sophisticated than that. But in the formation of any opinion, we still have identified with the perspective, and we've created a platform that we build a sense of self upon. In that progression from a raw experience of sensory data to the constructed opinion, we have created a self perspective, and that opinion helps to reinforce and hold that selfing process in place. If we adopt a view we have incarnated through that experience, a view is a trap. Even spiritual views are spiritual traps. Even if we have a view that everything is impermanent, to the extent that that is a view rather than an experience, we are trapped. If we've had an insight into emptiness and it is now an idea, a concept, and we hold it as truth, we are still trapped by that. It's only true when we are experiencing the emptiness, when we are seeing the impermanence of things. If we hold that experience as the way all things are, we're still trapped. It doesn't mean we should forget every insight that we had. We know them to be true, right? Without fixing on it as a belief, we can remember that and then with wisdom use it as a guide to see it again, to see it clearly, to look, to know what to look for in experience. Narkarjuna, an ancient Indian philosopher, said, "Believers in emptiness are incurable." Mindfulness meditation asks us not to believe in emptiness and not to believe that everything is changing. but to look at the mind, to look at the body, to look at the senses, and to see experience at a subtle level, to notice if there is grasping, if there is clinging, how does attachment form to things in the world? And how does attachment form to this self position, the self-ing, the self who is interpreting the world? The traditional model is to look at the five aggregates: materiality, feeling, perceptions, mental formations, and consciousness, or mind and matter, same thing. And to see how, when these aspects of mind and body are affected by clinging, it gives rise to a fixed viewpoint, a sense of self. And the Buddha describes four particular kinds of clinging that really trap us. How does clinging trap us? Why is clinging a trap? The image that's given is of a parrot trap, where in India they've devised this trap to catch parrots. And, you know, parrots, they're a kind of pest for farmers because they like to eat the grain. And so farmers don't like parrots because they, you know, they come and destroy the crops. So in the fields where a parrot might come, they set up these rings. And the rings are placed in such a way that the parrot will use it as a perch when it comes into the field. But as soon as the parrot lands on the perch, the weight of the parrot causes the ring to spin. And the instinct of the parrot, when confronted with that moving object, is to hold tighter. And so it grips the ring, and it spins with the ring as it's moving. This gives the farmers time to come into the field and to capture the parrot. I love this example because it really describes how clinging traps us. We do it. There's no actual trap there. There's no cage. But as long as we are holding on to things that are changing, to the moving dynamic processes of mind and body, as long as we're gripping on to it, we are caught. Those four things that we tend to grip onto include clinging to sensual pleasures, clinging to views and opinions, clinging to rites, rituals, conventions, or methods, and clinging to the concept of self. When we understand how this sense of self forms through attachment, the body, the mind, the perceptions, the experiences, all phenomena are seen as they are, empty of self. We still see them clearly. We don't fall into some space of emptiness, not perceiving anything. No, we see experience, but as not I, not me, not mine, just nature. We see the body and mind as it is. We see with wisdom or right view. And it is this seeing with wisdom or seeing with right view that is liberating. It's not a belief that is going to free us from ignorance and attachment. The freedom will come when we have such a clear perception of how things actually are that we finally stop grasping. So I don't want you to get the impression that a spiritual practice is going to have you floating through the world without having any opinions or any views. Because we shouldn't become kind of wishy-washy, inarticulate, indifferent sort of Buddhist blobs that just sit with our legs crossed saying, everything is fine, just as it is. Sometimes we have to take a stance. We have to have a clear enough perspective to speak of our experience, to share the wisdom that we have. We have to respond sometimes to the conditions in the world, whether those conditions be a dynamic in our family that we see as causing suffering, whether it's a dynamic within our own minds that we see are causing suffering, or whether it's a dynamic in our culture, in our world, in our communities that is causing suffering. Sometimes we have to take a stance on important concerns, important issues. So we need to be willing to express our perspectives, express our views and our opinions. And yet, we can still express those with clarity and with strength and know that it is only a viewpoint that we are sharing. It is only an opinion that we have. There's a standard, there was at the time of the Buddha a number of issues that were commonly debated. And over the course of time, they got sort of standardized in a kind of formula as what are called speculative views. And those included things like the world is eternal or the world is not eternal, the world is finite, the world is not, is infinite. Does the body exist? What exists after death? Is the body and the soul one thing, or are they different things? You know, these are issues that are still being explored in philosophy, in science, in religion. It's not like we've come to a definite conclusion that everybody agrees to. But in one discourse, different people stated these different views, and one of the Buddha's disciples, Venerable Ananda, was listening, and it was his turn to speak, and he did not confirm any of the views. He said instead, "Only this is true, anything else is worthless, is a viewpoint. To the extent that there are viewpoints, view stances, the taking up of views, obsession with views, the cause of views, and the uprooting of views, that's what I know. That's what I see. Knowing that, I say I know. Seeing that, I say I see. Why should I say I don't know, I don't see? I do know, I do see." Ananda didn't get pulled in to the particular views, the particular philosophies that were being discussed. He stepped back and looked at the process, the way in which individuals were constructing viewpoints, the way in which people were taking fixed stances. And that's what he saw, was how suffering was forming in the relationship to those views. And so that's what he spoke to. This is an important discourse because in the Buddhist tradition, wrong view is not about having an incorrect view, although that's also wrong view. Wrong view includes not seeing how mind and matter function, not seeing how attachment leads to suffering, not seeing how attachment to views leads to ignorance. Wrong view must be abandoned for the Noble Eightfold Path to arise. Abandoning wrong view is the first step, but then right view is understood as being beyond all positions for views. Right view is not the adopting of a more correct view. It's not about having a more accurate perspective. But right view is the ending of all attachments to misperceptions. So I'm not encouraging you to adopt my view or to become more accurate in your opinions. Any view that is affected by clinging is inherently a wrong view. The Buddha repeatedly encouraged his disciples to avoid arguments, to avoid disputes about these speculative views and philosophical positions, and to instead use one's time and one's energy to inquire into the core questions, the questions that actually have the potential to point out the causes of suffering and to free the mind from attachment as a cause of suffering. And so we question, what is suffering and what is the end of suffering? This is called the handful of leaves. And the story in the discourses is of a time when the Buddha was walking in the forest. And he reached down to the forest floor and he picked up a handful of leaves. And holding this handful of leaves, he said to his monks, he said, "My knowledge is like all the trees, all the leaves in the forest. But what I teach is like this handful of leaves. I teach suffering and the ending of suffering." There are so many things that we can know and that we can do in life. And we can sometimes feel a swirl of interests of getting perhaps even lost in all of the various possibilities in the spiritual life. But we should also know what is the handful of leaves, so that we don't lose track of the essence, the potential to fully comprehend and know what is suffering, the causes of suffering, to abandon the causes of suffering, and in that realize the ending of suffering. We'll just end with that verse again from the middle-length discourses. If a person has a belief, he preserves truth when he says, "My belief is thus." He does not yet come to the definite conclusion, "Only this is true. Anything else is wrong." Let's have a few quiet minutes, please.